You keep things simple.
I have so many complications in my life that occasionally I just try and do the simple thing. And the simple thing often ends up being the most complicated thing.
I think that's called the most complicated thing then.
Yes, Strakovsky's razor right there. So we're doing this first thing in the morning. So does that make it like the opposite of an after dark show? Like, do we have to be extra wholesome because it's like pre-dawn?
I don't know about you, but in the morning I tend to hate everything.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm a pretty happy person, but I don't get over this misery.
How do you do that? How do you be a happy person? Is that like, do you have to try? Do you have to work at it?
Oh,
or is
absolutely.
It just who you are? Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I grew up in like a New York Jewish type mentality, which has some stereotypical like kvetching about everything. Like, everything's wrong in the world. Let me point it out to you and remind you that it's all wrong. So to actively choose to notice anything positive, yeah, it's practice. And I think that's one of the greatest tricks the devil ever told, was that like people are naturally happy or unhappy.
Right.
It's just freaking practice.
Yeah. So deep down inside, you are an asshole just like the rest of us.
Oh God, yeah. No, right. Like, and it's easy for me. It's actually pretty natural for me to be mean to people if I wanted to be. Like, I love like quick-wittedness and like cutting observations. And that's my sense of humor, but that's like for my closest friends. Like, right. I love ripping on you that way, but I don't want people to feel like that's how I am with them. That's called being an asshole.
Right.
I feel like differentiating those two is an expertise that we all get to stumble our way toward. Mm-hmm. Why do you feel like you are miserable? Because I feel like you feign some misery. I don't know. I don't want to say feign it, but you're a nice person.
I'm not a horrible person, I am a horrible person. I attempt to work at being a better person, and I feel like you're much better at it than I am.
Oh,
and I just don't know if that's because you're more practiced at it or work harder at it, or you're just kind of more nice. So the reason I've been thinking about this is I've just started watching Ted Lasso.
No idea who that is.
All right. So it's on
Apple. Good show. Yes,
and
Apple Plus.
It's Ed Helms is a football coach that's been
soccer.
Shipped over to the US, sorry, to England, where he's been put in charge of a soccer team. Thank you, JJ, for correcting me when I didn't need to be corrected. Not that I would ever do that. And he's just kind of this, like, always, like, hardcore optimistic character. And people take advantage of it, but somehow he still sort of, like, gets through that and eventually, like, they start liking him and respecting him, even though they like hate the fact that he's always like optimistic and nice.
Yeah.
And it just got me thinking about like, is that a natural state for some people, or do they work at it, or because there are people like that. They're pretty rare,
sure.
But there are people like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm thinking of like one buddy who, he's always been painfully positive, and mm-hmm. I've never quite pinpointed on him. I get excited, and that can be mistaken for positivity.
Right.
Like, I'm just enthusiastic about stuff, right? So people are like, oh, you're so nice. I'm like, no, we're just talking about interesting stuff. Get me talking about like scheduling social media through a Java applet, and I'll just be miserable because I can't automate it and I can't do anything useful, and it's a waste of my time. But I do, like, the best manager I've ever had talks a lot about kind of choosing the framing in which you see something. And I, you know, at first I thought he was just that same sort of like, how are you so positive? How do people don't take advantage of that? And now I see like, he just kind of wills this direction through positivity.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't, you know, he defaults to that positive intent sort of mentality, but only when people earn it, right? Like that's the double-edged sword. You have to be guarded around some people if they mean you harm, That was a hard lesson for me not too long ago, a few years ago. But so many people do mean well. And yeah, the parsing of that, you know, I give the benefit of the doubt more because I'm in a position of privilege and comfort, and you know, I can take some chances there. But I don't know. Day to day, I have to keep a journal. Like, what am I grateful for today? And as no matter how cheesy that feels, our brains work really well when we prompt them. Mm-hmm. And we're like, spend a little energy to remind yourself of something you're happy about, and lo and behold, like, you remember a dozen other things you're happy about.
Right.
Like we have the framing effect is hugely influential. So I try to use it to my advantage. But Paul, you mentioned we should remind you of pirates for some reason. All right. So what the hell
is And I feel like it's a little bit topical, given what we're just talking about and trying to be a little bit better. And that is, how does a pirate know when his mate's doing a good job? He checks his OKRs.
That's so unfortunate. I like it. It's also like a little bit of an Intel joke in there, since OKRs were invented at Intel. Terrible idea. Do you use OKRs as a framework for mapping stuff?
We do, but it tends to be like, we just did a like word search and replace for KPIs to OKRs and called it done.
Okay. So I have an aha moment. I had an aha moment with OKRs in the last couple months. I, as you both know, and listeners might know by now, I really like productivity systems, and working through this Notion course by this guy who looks like a Bond villain, but is quite kind, named August Bradley. He has this like tiered system of how you can set goals for yourself. And I feel like I'm really good at day-to-day stuff, but like big projects, I fall apart. So using his system, and he has these tiers to it that map really well to OKRs. He calls them let me pull it up. You have a value goal, this thing that you can't quite quantify, but it aligns to your core values. And that's like, whether you realize it or not, like, you're doing a project because it aligns to that. And below that, there are these goal outcomes, which is where you get to the measurement, the sort of key results element of it. And I've read a few books on OKRs, and they never quite gave me that clarity of, like, you know, the objectives are always supposed to be like, you know, aspirational and not necessarily quantitative, while the key results are supposed to be quantitative and specific. But like, the idea of aligning it to your values at the top level, like, what are you actually trying to build and why do you care about anything? And then the goals that align to those values gave me that moment of like, oh yeah, that totally works. So I have my own OKR system in place, as you might imagine.
Now, you measure OKRs, right?
You measure them? Yeah, key results are the progress you're making towards the objective.
Right. And do you measure them using the metric system or the imperial system?
You know what? I wish I could. Speaking of things that you just kind of have in your head, whether you like it or not, the metric system is just so much better, but I go towards the imperial because, you know, the bathwater we were raised in here. Why do you get to lean on the metric because you came from down under?
Yeah, I still like front and center think in metric. And so like day to day, like weather temperatures, like I still have a hard time grappling with what 36 means, but I know exactly what zero means. You know, especially as it goes below freezing. Like, I don't know what 12 is, but I sure as hell know what -5 is.
I always learned it very easily, where 0 to 10, wear a jacket, 10 to 20, wear a hoodie, 20 to 30, you're okay. Everything over 30, it's fucking hot. And that's the short that I learned.
that's for Celsius, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Celsius. All right, good.
Everything over 30 is hot is a very Minnesotan way of thinking about weather and Fahrenheit.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I always kind of just think like 100 is 40. I mean, 100 is actually 38, but it's close enough. And then I sort of know the cooking temperatures, and that's kind of about it. Just sort of like instinctual knowledge of it versus having to like think about it and convert it in my head. Which is weird because I've been here for what, nearly 11 years. So you'd think I would be better at it by now. But I guess it's just what you grew up with. And like so much of how you think about the world is in the measurement system you were growing up with. Same with miles versus kilometers or feet versus meters. I'm much better off. I'm still much better at like understanding in my head what a meter is versus what 3.2 feet is or whatever the conversion.
Yeah.
And maybe that's because I need to stop trying to convert it in my head and just like roll with like a foot is a foot versus a foot is about a third of a meter.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's like is it a kind of axiom in your head or is it like a conversion point where where my friends that are better at language than me say like they can remember the moment where it went from like they were translating Spanish in their head to they were thinking in Spanish in their head.
Right.
And that's like the fluency of it hits that point. I still think about it like when I try to learn a new technology, for better or worse, I like always work from analogy, like from a programming language. I'm like, oh, how would I do this in Ruby? And from like a technology standpoint, it's what is this like in a storage architecture? Because I'm like, the first thing I learned really deeply is are SANs. And for better or worse, like I try to learn networks based on like storage architecture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, being able to frame things on things you know well or past experiences is pretty important. So we're always.
Yeah. And to your point, like who's to say we even have a choice?
It's like, right.
It's just in there till you get there. Yeah.
So why do you think it is that the US hasn't ever made the switch? Because like every country that uses metric made that switch at some point, right?
Sure.
My parents were kids when Australia made the switch. And I know it was, from the sound of things, it was not trivial, but at the same time, it wasn't ridiculously difficult. And I guess you have the thing where anyone who refuses or can't learn the metric system, well, that problem solves itself because eventually they get old and die.
Yeah. It's like comically off as I think about our current political state and how there's just such a rejection of other and we think we are unique and different and better in all ways. So, but I'm trying to rewind to, you know, more your parents' generation. Like we've had some moments when we were decent-ish international citizens. I don't know, like there is a forever like American exceptionalism, and I wonder, I don't know why it's more interesting than it looks on the surface. Like I don't know why literally the measurement is the thing where like, no, we will die on that hill.
My philosophy has always been the amount of time invested initially is always the scary thing, right? Where imagine the logistics of getting every single U.S. state to change their signs from miles per hour to kilometers per hour. Now, we can't even get them to agree on some of the most basic things in the world. And for us to force that level of cooperation is just something nobody ever wants to do. Like no one wants to take that mantle, right? So we're never going to change because it's such a Herculean thing to do. It's the same argument. It's the same argument with everyone moving to UTC across the world, right? Like it'd be Herculean to convince every single person on the planet that time zones don't exist, or should say, the standard time across the world is something best for everybody, but to convince every single person to do that, it would just be ridiculous. No?
I mean, yeah, I would like to see actual evidence that everyone switching to UTC would be better. Okay. I mean, okay, certainly so I like the idea, but like, I don't know if it's like, if it would really be an improvement. And I wonder if there's some natural affinity to the way we think about time that's specific to like how the day progresses that might be really difficult for people. But I feel like the metric system, I guess there's no real evidence that it is better apart from what? It being more accurate.
Yeah, and everything actually fits together in a logical pattern.
Right, but like day to day, how does that affect like Bobby Sue down at the grocery store trying to buy bananas, right?
Yeah, sure. Like I don't know Bobby Sue well, so I don't.
Asking
I don't
for know kilograms versus pounds of bananas is like doesn't matter. So yeah. I get for where measurements are really, really important in like scientific circles, in surveying things, and it kind of surprises me that those industries haven't just made a shift, sort of regardless of what the general population is doing. Like if you can be more accurate and more precise and have easier conversion between units, you would think that as an industry, you would head towards that versus just using whatever it is that everyone else uses.
I don't know. I only speak in furlongs. So, you know, and barrels.
I really stick to nautical knots for all measurement, whether we're on water or not. I just love how confusing it is. But
AJ, only thing you should measure in barrels is fish and monkeys.
Ice and beer.
It's un-American to not measure oil.
That's true.
Yeah. But you know, JJ, on the impossibility of getting people to adopt things, like, yeah, forcing, you know, this is where language is everything. We're like, we have systems of influence throughout the United States that are reasonably effective in certain times. Like the drinking age is not mandated nationally, but it is strongly encouraged, and there are incentives. There's additional funding for each state if you comply to the 21-year age. And you could do similar things to nudge people that way. And then this is also like hardcore human psychology. Like, how can we frame it? So like, there's like either, if we're into the exclusivity of it, like make it exclusive to be the first one to choose it. Or if we like this, whatever narrative we have to tell ourselves that like, I think right now it runs incongruently to the narrative that like we are the best and we are different because we're better because we're different. So the idea of, you know, this sort of global compliance and caring about the commons is like runs incongruently to that. But there are, to your point, Paul, like it'd be cool if like, hey, not everyone in America cares, but if you like cooking at all, you're using milliliters and grams. Like that would be a cool movement and a great way to sort of like make it normal in a subgroup so that it has like a chance to permeate the total.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, speaking of cooking, I'm a big fan of using kitchen scales, right? I hate any recipes that are cups or whatever, because it's so like it's really imprecise. And there are things where you need precision, like baking and stuff like that. Where you switch to metric, and if you tell me you want 250 milliliters of a liquid, I can either measure that in a cup or I can just weigh it, because a milliliter of water is a gram of water. So
that is magic.
Like, oh, you want 250 mil? Okay, I'll just pour 250 grams of water or milk or whatever. And it's done. Now, there are differences, like oil is a little bit lighter or whatever, but those differences in that smaller amount are so minor that you can kind of get away with it. And I find that fantastic. Just that simple. And of course, you can convert imperial volume into imperial weight, but it's like, it's a lot of math versus it's exactly the same number.
Yeah, so converting Fahrenheit to Celsius, like we were attempting before, we're like grown ass people that have learned complicated technologies are like, is it 37 or 38 or whatever? Yeah, it's stupid. So like,
yeah. And then the other thing I love is watching like in the hardcore scientific circles as they find more precise measurements for the original unit.
What? Tell and me so, more. Like, I'm not familiar with this.
Yeah, me neither.
Well, so like every unit in the metric system is based off a real thing. And as science gets better, it gets to be even more precise. And so I'm trying to think of a good example. Even if it's just like distance, like they're down to like the original source of like distance has to do with like the width of like an atom or an electron or like a very specific, very small thing. And then everything is built from there. And occasionally, like every 5 or 6 years, they find a new way to be more precise about that original measurement based on like yet another smaller thing or yet another thing that is more precisely the same in every situation. Because you think about like the width of an atom is probably affected by gravity.
Yeah, sure.
Right. And so the width of an atom on Earth is going to be different to a width of an atom on Mars.
Mm.
And therefore, like, they talk about the imprecision of that, which is bananas, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, it's really cool that, like, the system is based on such, like, precise things. And they're still continuously looking for ways to make them more precise. I think I would have to hunt it down, but the most recent one I think was based on like weight. So like the original way to know what exactly a gram is. And it's like, it was pretty bananas reading. I wish I could remember it, but I remember reading the article going, oh my God, they can measure to this.
Wait, yeah, I'm just imagining like a foot is actually like 38 trillion quarks or something.
Right.
Just like down to a level of precision I had no idea we were measuring. Yeah, that is neat. I do love when people are like in it, like really in whatever they're doing. Definitely have some envy there. Like I can't get to that level of specificity without being like, am I being myopic? And you're like, yeah, you have to be that expert.
Right.
So speaking of myopic strategies, not really. But JJ, you're using a tool that we all wish we could maybe quit. But you've got a Nagios button that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah. So over the last couple of weeks, if you get on any Zoom calls with me, you might notice my room has changed. So I did the yearly or however long you should rewire and reorganization of my desk and my office to kind of get stuff in a little bit better state. I even got a green screen. I don't have it up right now, obviously, but.
Oh, hey, someone's in the kitchen. Hi.
Yeah, exactly. You can see in the kitchen now.
I like it. It's a fresh angle.
Yeah.
And I even have a little light right there. If you see it's red, I can change it. I can change it from my laptop. See now it's green.
The old permission to knock light. Yep.
Well, it's good for the girls, right? Like I got two young girls and they never know if I'm actually like, because I have my headphones on my back to the window or the door. Like they don't know. Anyway, so I reorganized the room and I rediscovered my Stream Deck. So in the process, I tried to figure out what to do with it because I've gotten to the habit where I only have a handful of scenes now that I use when I stream. So I don't really use it for streaming anymore. So I tried to think of things to use with it because it's a really useful tool. I know there's uses for it, but I can't put my finger on it.
And the funny part was, you don't use it for streaming anymore?
Not really, no. Like wow, I try.
I use mine like every single stream, like to switch between scenes and... Okay.
I mean, I have like two scenes, right? Like I have like the picture of me sharing the desktop and the picture of me with other people. Yeah, right. Okay. Like that's it. And if I need to like go on break or something, I can be like, I need to go on a break, and you can see me look for the screen to do it. Like I don't have that habit of hitting the button.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of weird, but it's true. So I started playing around with it, and I realized that you could set up direct websites from it, at least on the Mac version, because I have it plugged into a Mac. So I put not just a Nagios button on it, because I got a little alarm from one of my Nagios box telling me one of my machines was down. So I was like, hey, that'd be kind of cool to hit a button and all of a sudden have Nagios pop up and tell me what's wrong. So I ended up putting in quite a few. I realize this is a audio podcast and not a great visual medium, but if you guys see now, is this going to work? Yeah, it kind of works.
We're doing this? We're doing this. Okay.
Yes, we are. We're doing this. So as you see, I got the Nagios button up on the top.
There's a Trello button.
There's
an IBM button.
Yep.
What the hell is going on?
Yeah, and I also have a keep button on there and a zoom button on there. I couldn't actually get the zoom plugin to work. So now I can hit a button and I can pop up my zoom if I need to. Pop up my IBM email or my wiki for my note taking, and to Robert's point, Trello. So now if I'm like trying to think of something and all of a sudden I have a brainstorm. If I have a brainstorm, something I need to do, I hit this button and Trello pops up. I could put a card in and go back to what I was doing. And already that's captured so many things that I usually drop. So it seems pretty good. Yeah.
Way to find a flow. Yeah. Paul, you're on mute.
I am on mute.
Very 2021 of you.
Yeah. So speaking of the Zoom plugin, I did get it to work.
Oh.
And it was hot garbage.
Oh, really?
And I'm sorry to whoever did it. I'm sure that it's probably because you developed it on a different system than mine. And maybe it works great on 90% of machines. But it's that thing where it works sometimes, but not always.
Mm.
And that's almost always worse than it never working.
Yeah.
Right. So when I hit the mute button, there's a 1 in 10 chance it mutes right away. There's like a 4 in 10 chance that it mutes after 2 seconds. And then there's a 5 in 10 chance it just doesn't do anything.
That's amazing.
Right. And so I set up all these buttons to do like mute, show video, share screen, like all the things you might want to do on a frequent thing, like record. And it's just not quite instantaneous or reliable enough to use it. Like when I want to mute, I don't want to wait 3 seconds to mute because I'll probably have already sneezed or, you know, whatever it is I tried to mute for.
Exactly. Yeah. So while we're talking about Stream Decks, yeah, getting it set up, I'm only using Linux these days, and my Stream Deck's just the brick in the background because default app running for it is Mac or Windows only. But I did find there's a Python UI based one that works that I've got going some places. But I feel like, you know, like a dog that just bit a bumper. Like I'm with you, JJ. I don't know what to put on there. Mm-hmm. I mostly just enjoy that there's a library that I can go from a Python command line and like turn my key light on and off and change the color. That's all I'm not using the Stream Deck at all. I got the Mini with the intention of starting to set up scenes and start streaming like you guys are. But I think I'm probably going to go the direction you are of just like a launcher, like of apps. And if I can set it up in a way, so at least in this one, you can write scripts and like the button initiates the script so you can have it toggle on and off. So maybe like launch an app, close an app. If I tap twice, that could be kind of nice, but it's just a lot of work.
I have had pretty good success using it to drive like hotkeys. Mm-hmm. And so in Zoom, you can actually say, I want this hotkey to be a global hotkey, which means it works even if Zoom's not in focus. And so I am able to fairly reliably have a mute, unmute, camera, un-camera, using those hotkeys.
That's nice.
And that works pretty well when I'm trying to do streaming where I am using Zoom as well as OBS and wanting to like sometimes show my camera, sometimes not, especially if it's a separate streaming machine. And that's worked really well, especially with like the you can set up multi actions. So I'll have an action that unmutes my microphone, starts my video, and then switches to a scene. Mm. And then I hit the next scene and it does kind of the opposite and it flicks my microphone and camera back off. And that way I can choose when to send stream contents into Zoom versus not. And okay. I've been using that quite a bit because if you have the paid version of Zoom, you can actually tell Zoom to stream for you.
Ooh.
And it puts a watermark down the corner and stuff, which if you're a paid customer, you can have somewhat customized. But it means that when I can help other people stream easier because they don't need to have OBS and all of those things. And so to stay consistent, I've been switching some of my streaming setups to use the same so that whether it's me that's doing the streaming or Tiffany that's doing the streaming, it looks the same to the people viewing.
Nice.
And I've found that super useful.
Hey, question for you though, Paul. Is the config that you've got set up for your Stream Deck, have you found that, is there a file somewhere where that is codified that could go into version control?
Absolutely. Yeah. So you can export the Stream Deck profile and you can export all the OBS bits. So it's, I can basically, here's everything, go for it. The only thing is if you have things that are file path specific, you have to fix those on the second machine. I mean, but otherwise it works great.
Yeah.
Then you can have multiple profiles on your Stream Deck and you can actually use Stream Deck buttons to switch profiles.
Yeah, totally. So that's why I'm a little mind blown given the, you know, preference of Stream Deck by so many people in our community. I'm shocked there isn't a better exchange system through GitHub of like profiles and OBS config. Like I feel like we need like a little bit of a powwow as a community of nerds with little buttons on our desk.
Yeah, absolutely.
And share that config. I started like one weekend, I started to put together the workarounds I'm doing for Linux, but I didn't have anything to load in. So I don't know. Let's bookmark that. If you are also a listener with a Stream Deck, speak up in our chat on SoftwareDefinedTalk/Slack or just ping us on Twitter so that we can know and maybe start an exchange system.
You know, maybe we could try and do is build a definitive like Zoom Deck using the shortcuts and stuff, and maybe have like a Windows version, a Mac version, and a Linux version, because that covers all three of us. Yeah, and like have the same layout and the same buttons, but have it do the right thing on the different operating systems.
I'd love that.
That'd be fun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, a little project for us.
All right.
I dig it. All right. Another thing that Paul, you said to ask about is that you have a new greeting.
So
I want to hear about that.
We got on a call, like my team at work, and of course did the usual, hey, how's it going? And there's no good answer to that anymore, right? Because everyone is fucking miserable. And we then were talking about how that's like a ridiculous question. And it's just like, well, it's always just been a thing you say. But now, like, I think a lot of us are at the point where we're just being honest about that instead of like, fine, right? A lot of us are just like, terrible, of course. And so we were like, well, what do we need? We need something different. And I was like, well, why don't we just congratulate each other for like mustering the energy and the strength to do whatever it is that we're doing, in this case, getting on a call. And we're like, that's great. So now we're like, when we get on a call with each other, like the first thing we say is congratulations. And we've been enjoying it. And then so someone, I think it might have been Ashley McNamara, mentioned something on Twitter about, you know, why do we still ask the how are you? It's like basically the same conversation. And so I said, well, this is what we started doing. We started saying congratulations. And I didn't give a ton of context because it's Twitter. And some dude like attacked me. And I, about, you know, if you came onto my call with that sort of eternal optimism, I like reach through the Zoom and punch you in the face. I'm like, whoa, okay.
Whoa.
So first of all, like, if you'd ever met me, you would understand that there is nothing optimistic about this, just from the fact it's me. Yeah. And like, what are you doing? And then he's like, well, you know, we tried to be blah blah blah, and then like blah blah blah, and then. Like, we're like, oh my God, this like thing is actually affecting everyone and you're minimizing it and all this. I'm like, no one's minimizing anything, dude. Like, I'm really sorry I like affected you in this way. It was not my intention, but clearly I did. So I'm sorry. And he was like, oh yeah, I really respect that. I was just trying to nudge you in the direction. I'm like, dude, you attacked me. There was no nudging. What?
Yeah.
Oh man, you got replied guide.
Yeah, yeah, it was quite interesting and odd. And I'm like, okay, cool. You don't like what I said? That's nice. Moving on.
Well, I think it's good for you. Like, we all need a good, like, oh, this is the shitty part of Twitter that people talk about that we only see very occasionally. that sucks. I think that's a great inside joke, you know, like, congratulations. But yeah, I can also understand why people wouldn't get it at scale. Like, you have to know that you are funny in order to accept that as funny. That sucks, man. But I'm definitely holding a little bonus space on Twitter, especially of like people popping off when they see something that annoys them. Because like, yeah, we are on edge a little bit more than we have been. That said, I did immediately want to be like, don't yell at my Paul. Only I can yell at my Paul. Anyway, that's bad. okay. Well, hey, I need a food update for you all.
Tell us. Give us your food update.
I just finished the chunk of chashu I cut off this last one. And I cooked, I think, just three bowls of ramen for Adele and myself this week. And God damn, it was so good. It was so good. And it was the first time I tried to do it in a pot in the oven, like this way. And I realize now, like, I put the lid on the pot directly on it. Like, I didn't crack it or like have any sort of holes in it to regulate the heat. We can return to that. But this time I did sous vide style, after what you said, Paul, and JJ, I feel like you're my sous vide evangelist here. And it was just like buttery and succulent and perfectly flavored. So it was just the perfect piece of pork on top of many bowls of ramen.
So what you did, 165 for, I assume it's pork belly, 165, 170 for like 8 to 12 hours? Is that roughly
close? I went from, there's a guy that goes by Ramen Lord who he got his following on Reddit, really thoughtful, non-pretentious guides to cooking ramen at like an intermediate level. And he gave a scale of like, depending on how you want it to come out. I wanted it on the softer side, so I went with a slightly higher heat at 175. And really just out of apathy at waking up too early, I cooked it for 14 hours. I was planning to do around 12, but I slept in. I didn't want to wake up at 6. That was the timing of it.
And so you did some sort of marination before you cooked it?
Totally, yeah. So in the bag was, nothing too complex. Like some brown sugar, ginger, garlic, soy, dark soy, little mirin.
So just kind of your standard basic tare kind of.
Exactly. So if you're messing around with ramen, it's one metric tare.
Yeah.
I did nothing special at all. Because I just wanted to see if it worked on its own. And it was fun. I got the roll on it too. We're like really folded it over and tied it. It's just so damn good.
Nice. What was I going to ask you about? So what did you do with the liquid in the bag when you were done?
Oh yeah, saved it on the side, kind of strained the bits of it out, and I haven't done too much. I tried to make a tare for the first ramen. I was following like this. The first time I was trying to do a proper shoyu ramen, so it's like more minimalist, like simpler flavors, and it was super bland in there. It wasn't enough, at least for my palate, when I was used to these like miso bombs that I've been doing over and over again. So it just, at best it tasted like bath water. At worst, it tasted like toilet water, is like how I described that meal. I was so pissed.
Right. that happens to the best of us.
Yeah. The more I'm reading, the ramen forums, it's like, if you haven't done that yet, you haven't been, you know, toying around.
So what I would recommend doing with that liquid is actually bringing it to a boil for a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And that will help any proteins and stuff that are in there will like coagulate and go to the top, and you can like scoop it out. And that'll give you a much cleaner, purer liquid. And then you can use that almost as a like the base of a tare. I wouldn't say it's quite complete enough to call a tare, but with a bit of... a bit of boosting with some flavors and stuff, it'll turn into a pretty good tare. And it'll also have a decent amount of porkiness to it because it was, you know, a bunch of pork juices came out into it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, of course, you'll also, when you refrigerate it, it'll set because it's got enough collagen and stuff. It'll be basically like a jello. And you'll also get a really good layer of fat on the top. You can also kind of use sparingly as a bit of a flavoring agent because, you know, in ramen, you have that kind of like oil or flavored fat that you usually add at the last minute.
Yep. Yeah, that's been a game changer of realizing like that is a important aspect of the five parts of ramen, like the separate oil. And it's called oil, but then everyone recommends using pork fat by default or chicken fat. So oil, big air quotes.
Yeah.
And I have like a little jar of fat on the side that I've been scooping in and melting down with some aromatics. And
nice.
Yeah, it's been working out. Like I'd like to mess around with like a shio or shoyu, like these kind of lighter, clearer broth salt based ones. But I think I need to branch into the MSG space, which just adds that, you know, bump of flavor that we all expect as American palates, and also knowingly the science shows that there's no harm to your head and no headaches from it.
Yeah, absolutely. And like if you have access to the really good Japanese ingredients, like the really good seaweed, the really good shaved bonito flakes, etc., and you can use those, you have less need for something like MSG because they contain so many of the MSG components in them.
Glutamates.
Right. but if you don't have access to those, or you're a home kitchen, like buying huge bags of really expensive bonito shavings doesn't necessarily make a ton of sense. But adding in a teaspoon or whatever of MSG can get you like 3/4 of the way there. Then add in 3/4 of a teaspoon of like MSG and like don't be precious about it.
Yeah, I'm super down for it. But I'll report back after I branch into that space. I think that's a topic onto itself.
Absolutely. The other thing to think about MSG-wise is a lot of the powdered stocks are pretty heavy in MSG and salt. And so if you're using like powdered stock, like powdered chicken stock or something as a base, check on that before you add more salt or more MSG.
Mm.
The other good thing that liquid would be for before we move on from your cooking adventure would be for your ajitama eggs.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And speaking of ajitama eggs, so I made some the other day for the ramen, which you saw the photo of. And I'll talk about exactly what I did in a bit. But for the eggs, I did the usual brought water to a boil with a splash of vinegar and a little bit of salt. I actually pricked the bottom of the eggs. And what that does is there's a pocket of air in the bottom of an egg, and that'll basically expand as the egg cooks, and it actually pushes the yolk to one side. And so you end up with kind of an uneven egg. So you can combat that by stirring and agitating the eggs as they're cooking, or you prick a little hole in the bottom so that there's space somewhere for the air to go as it expands. And also having a bit of vinegar and salt in the water will cause any egg that comes out of that hole to immediately solidify. And so you're not going to lose a ton of egg out the hole, even if you do have like a small thin trail of it. And so that was, I think, 6 minutes because I use large eggs. If you use extra large, maybe 7 minutes. Straight into an ice bath, worked really well. Then what I did was I put them in a vacuum bag with like maybe a couple of teaspoons of tare, and then used the vacuum sealed it on like the slow, gentle setting until like most of the air was gone, but I wasn't sucking all of the sauce out of the end of the bag.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked really well, like overnight. And they were just as good as ones that I've soaked in like cups worth of tare. And so that's a good way to conserve your tare, because you can kind of reuse that liquid, but like it definitely kind of comes with an egginess.
Yeah. I don't know. I think so maybe I prefer my chilies have burnt the egginess out of it.
There is that.
But and yeah, so, I like your strategy. It's interesting that like I haven't messed with the prick and the vinegar. Like I'm reading J. Kenji Lopez Alt's the Food Lab,
mm-hmm.
and he based on his empirical research believes those things to be myths, that the prick will guarantee it, or the vinegar does definitely coagulate the whites of the egg, right. But it can lead to like a premature rubberiness of the egg. So he said like he likes to push people to cook it a little longer and mm-hmm. avoid the rubberiness. I had my first egg I intended to be ajitama that I ripped a chunk of by deshelling it. I was like, son of a, but 99 times out of 100, I'm able to get like a clean pull on that after like I do a 9 minute boil. And like, I find it to be like after it congeals, it's like that perfect sort of congealed egg, which I enjoy as
that's getting pretty close to like that. I guess that would be firm boiled rather than soft.
Sure. Yeah. I think, it's definitely closer to a firm boil. Like, Yeah, if I cut it right in half hot and put it on top, it would be a little runny.
Right.
But after cooling it, it gets like that. I think it's like a really beautiful orangish yellow.
Sets like a custard almost.
Yeah, like a custard.
Yeah.
I think that's delicious, but mm-hmm. there's such a personal preference there. I did figure out a trick, though. I have like a little basket that I put over while I'm heating up the soup. I put a basket with the two eggs that I want to serve in there.
Yes.
And put a lid on top just to like, just to bring them back up to temperature, and it doesn't cook them. And it gets that warmth back, which is a good aha moment. Cause I'm like, you have this cold egg dropping into hot soup. That wasn't as appetizing as I'd like.
Yeah. So, the bowl of ramen I cooked, which I'll try and get through real quick, cause we don't want to take up too much time, but our local grocery store, HEB, love HEB. They had pork shoulder on sale for $1 a pound. And so I bought all the pork shoulder and I smoked probably 5 shoulders. And so I did just the usual smoking. Don't want to go into too much detail. I wrapped it 3/4 of the way through. And when I wrapped it, I added kind of a mix of some stock, a little bit of apple cider vinegar and some other stuff. And then after it was finished, I decanted the cooking juices that were formed into that, into a container. And I kind of used that as the base for my stock. So I used probably half to 3/4 chicken stock and then some of that in there. And that kind of acted as effectively my tare, kind of like a barbecue version of a tare. And then I used the fat that had congealed on the top of that as kind of part of the oil. And I used that with my regular oil, which is, I think, pork fat that I cooked a bunch of garlic and green onions in. Yep. And so that kind of was the basis. Oh, and I used a big scoop of chili crisp as well.
Yeah.
Because I'd done it a little bit spicy on my rub, so I wanted to bring that through to the ramen. And other than that, cooked my ramen, did my ajitama eggs, which I just told you about. And then with the pulled pork, I didn't actually pull it. Mm. I chilled it in whole pieces. Because if you want to store it, chill it and reheat it. If it's already pulled, it'll dry out pretty easy. But if it's in a whole chunk, it's much harder for it to dry out. But if you heat that back up to 165, either sous vide or in a low oven in foil or whatever, it still pulls like magic. And so I had these whole chunks. So I sliced it just like you would your chashu and then put it under the broiler to brown one side and ended up with this pork that was like deliciously crispy on the top side. But also like as soon as you touched it, it basically fell apart because it was effectively pulled pork.
Oh, God.
And so I managed to handle it just carefully enough to get it into the bowl and like the whole slices. But then as soon as I went to grab a piece with my chopsticks, it would like that piece would just like come right off. It was so good.
Amazing.
Oh, and then to top it, because it's like now barbecue ramen, I sliced a like a whole pickle and used that as one of like the ramen garnishes. And it was so good.
I love that. We'll pick up this thread. I think the homemade fusion recipes around ramen are really encouraged and it's really fun to mess with.
Yeah, I think once you've got like the basic understanding of it, you can kind of play around with stuff like that. Not saying that I'm an expert or anything, and I certainly wouldn't want to open a fusion ramen restaurant or something, but I know just enough I can like play with the different ingredients and flavor profiles, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, let's bring us to a close with our usual. What are people cooking this weekend or baking? JJ?
Well, in Austin, Texas right now, it is very cold. And
tell me about it.
Well, for Texans, it's very cold. the one thing that today is my youngest daughter's birthday.
Oh, happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
I know she's a listener.
Absolutely. Actually, she is. She asked me to play this on Mondays when I take her back from school. She's like, the one the mushrooms on.
And I'm
like,
but really? If she's listening, I'm still finding sand on my car.
So I am going to be playing with hot chocolate recipes this weekend.
Fun.
Because everybody loves hot chocolate. And there's enough of a cold weather to be able to get that going. So that's my goal. Hopefully next week I can report back with some good findings, and then we can talk about that.
All right. Here's a target for you. Try and get to the hot chocolate like what we had in Barcelona.
Yes.
I say Barcelona because I've been there once, so I'm an expert on everything Catalan.
Yes. Gracias.
Because that was like super thick and rich and delicious. And then you can get some delicious churros from your local churrascaria. Mm-hmm. And that will be fantastic.
I was leaning towards the Bailey's version of hot chocolate for daddy, but you know, that's a different conversation.
Well, if you do that though, you want a good thick chocolate to put that in because you don't want it to be super runny and thin because you've added too much liquid, right?
So that means I can drink it faster.
Mm.
If it's not,
Gigi's optimizing for different metrics, Paul.
Yeah.
What are you? What are you cooking this weekend, Paul?
I haven't figured that out yet because I just did a massive batch of pulled pork, and so I have a lot of that lying around. So I might make a few more bowls of ramen with that. I was without power for like nearly 10 hours yesterday because of the cold.
Oh my god!
Because it hasn't been this cold for so long. All the trees that were overhanging power lines, like lost branches and broke power lines. And you could tell every time they fixed it, the power would come back on and like 2 minutes later it would drop again as they were like fixing different branches over power lines. So I'm not really planning on doing too much because I don't trust that the power is going to stay up, given that it's going to keep getting colder until we're predicted to hit, is it 9 degrees, JJ?
Yep. Or seven? 9 degrees on Tuesday.
That's my range. That shouldn't be your range.
Which is cold, which will be officially the coldest it's ever been in Austin, Texas. That's like amazing. In recorded history.
Yeah. Wild. Well,
that was 1989. Okay.
Yeah, that's close enough.
I remember some metric about that.
It's negative 11 in Minneapolis right now, and it's expected to be about that for another week. So I'm going to stick to my my warm soups. I've been messing with this. There is like a soft tofu, kimchi, and radish soup that is absolutely delicious. And I use some like homemade stock as the base for it. And like some of the gochujang, probably saying that wrong, like the fermented hot peppers.
Gochujang?
Gochujang. Yeah, exactly. And then some miso because why not? So I'm going to make a huge pot of that, but I'm trying a different tofu this round. Like I really, at a Korean restaurant, I really enjoy like some of the soft tofu dishes. I feel like it's just like, it's like fluffy and flavorful, but I've never messed with that at home. I've always stuck to like hard or extra firm, and I'm going to do like a medium firmness and see if I can.
Yeah, that's working with soft tofu is pretty hard in soups and stuff because once it's in, you can't really stir it. Otherwise, it like just falls apart.
Right. Yeah, so I'm going to try to only, I'm going to warm it on the side, put some on top of each serving, and then like store it separately is my intention.
Yeah, and the other thing to do is bring some soup, pretty salty water to the boil and just like lower it gently into that and have it just under a simmer for a few minutes. And that will actually help firm it up a little bit. And it will also leach out any of the kind of taste from the, like, sitting around in, like, the water.
Right.
How it sort of sits in the water in the container.
Absolutely,
yeah. Cleans up the taste of it a little bit. And it's a little bit easier to handle without breaking when you get to, like, the softer tofus, if you've done that.
Yeah, but I'll keep that in mind. Yeah, I'm going to try a couple different strategies and report back. Just good to have that heat on the inside for the heat that is lacking outside.
Absolutely. Now, is it is the recipe one of those ones where you start by like simmering a whole chicken to sort of create the soup base?
Oh, that sounds brilliant. No, this is super lazy. This is like you're done in 20 minutes if you want to be.
And that's also a great thing.
Yeah. It's really just like warming up some stock with some aromatics and then putting the radish in early so that it absorbs all that flavor and softens to the appropriate level. And then you just layer on top and it's super quick and been a great, like I'll whip it up over lunch if we're in a bind. Yeah. So
it's delicious.
Yeah. All those meals sound great. Always fun to talk to you all. Thank you for listening, dear listeners. Keep giving us that feedback in Software Defined Talk or on Twitter. And we will catch you next week.
Bye.
Bye. And congratulations.
Congratulations. You made it.